We're all born blind. A few years ago in the state of California, there was an incident that occurred involving an elderly woman who had been shopping in a local grocery store. When she returned to her car in the parking lot, she noticed that four men she did not recognize were getting into her car. The woman immediately dropped her grocery bags, reached into her purse, and pulled out a small handgun that she carried for protection. She ran to the front of the car, aimed the pistol at the men, and began screaming at them at the top of her lungs. She ordered them, "Get out of the car," and warned them if they didn't, she'd blow their brains out. "I know how to use this gun, and don't think I won't," she screamed. Well, the four men didn't hesitate. They threw open the car doors, scrambled out, and started running away as fast as they could. And the woman was trembling from the experience, but she kept her composure. And when she was certain all the men were gone, she put her gun back in her purse, picked up her groceries, and loaded them into the back seat of the car. She climbed into the driver's seat and decided that she would go immediately to the police station and report this incident. But there was a small problem. Her key didn't fit in the ignition. A quick glance around the interior of the car confirmed what you already suspect. She was in the wrong car. Her vehicle was parked four spaces away in the same aisle of the same parking lot. Well, she quickly loaded her bags into her own car and she drove to the police station to confess what she had done. When she told her story to the staff sergeant at the desk, he could not control his laughter. He pointed to the other end of the counter where four very shaken young men were reporting a carjacking by a mad elderly white woman. And by the way, the woman apologized and no charges were ever filed. I tell you that story because it just goes to show you that things are not always what they first appear, are they? I'm sure that all of us on some occasion have jumped to a conclusion only to find out that we've been badly mistaken. Now, I'm not saying you pull out a gun, but you may have hurt someone with an unkind word or a gesture because you didn't have all the facts. Perhaps you've spread a rumor that isn't true, or you failed to include someone in your circle of friends all because of a negative judgment. Like the woman in the parking lot, many of us have a tendency to assume the worst about other people. Our attitude might be, we don't think, we just know that we are right and they are wrong. In John chapter 9, Jesus is making his way out of the temple. He had just completed a very nasty exchange with the religious leaders of his day in which he was accused in just one encounter of being demon-possessed, a Samaritan, being too young, and on top of all that, they threatened to stone him to death. It was awful. This was a frightening encounter, and the venom spit at Jesus was truly hateful. To avoid being stoned, as it was not yet his time for death, Jesus makes his way out of the temple courtyard. And he's followed immediately by his disciples. Now, I should point out to you, there's a lot of debate among scholars as to whether this was his 12 disciples following him or some others that were following Jesus. Nevertheless, as they're walking along, Jesus stops and he begins to focus on a man who was blind from birth. Now, the description of the man was meant to indicate to us that he had some kind of birth defect that left him blind. This is a man who had never seen anything. And because of his blindness, he was relegated to the only option he had in his day and society to support himself. He was begging on the street. He was living off the charity of others. The result of this economic situation was that, clearly, he lived in poverty. He lived on the streets. The disciples happen to notice that Jesus is giving some attention to this man, and they ask a question. a question asked out of judgment. Why was this man born blind? Was it the result of his own sin or the sin of his parents? I will stop right there and say that I heard another theory that if you want to hear it, you have to tune in to talk back on Wednesday. Or ask my mother today, she'll tell you. In other words, surely someone did something wrong to cause this man's affliction. This situation of suffering is born out of the Ten Commandments. It's recorded in Exodus chapter 20, verses 5 and 6. And there we read these words. I do not leave unpunished the sins of those who hate me, but I will punish the children for the sins of the parents to the third and fourth generations. But I'll lavish my love on those who love me and obey my commands, even for 1,000 generations. Some of the authoritative rabbis held that not only could the sins of the parents leave a mark on their children, an infant, they also believed that the baby could sin in its mother's womb. Now, the disciples are not necessarily being mean in their questions. They're simply expressing what was a common theology of their day. If something bad happens to you, you must have offended God somehow. Lots of people believe that today. Genetic defects in infants caused the Jewish scholars a lot of difficulty. Thus, they blame the parents for the children's situation, or in the case of some parents, the blame was somehow shifted to the child. How a fetus could sin is beyond me, but they believed it. On the other side of the coin, of course, is if you are living a blessed life, everything's going well, you must have pleased God somehow. It was a commonly held belief that good and bad things were a direct consequence of a reward and punishment transaction with God. So when the disciples looked at this man born blind, they judged him and his parents as being responsible for his situation. Now I must confess that I was tempted to think that this opinion of the disciples was no longer employed in our modern society, and I was very wrong. That I remembered that years ago, 2008 for example, or to be exact, I was at a Mission Expo in Toronto, and Rick Tobias, who at that time was leading the Yonge Street Mission, maybe many of you have met or heard about him, Neil Hetherington was chairing Habitat for Humanity in Toronto. He's now part of Daily Bread Food Bank. And Tim Huff was also presenting. He's with Light Patrol. Among the many wonderful insights presented by this panel was the eye-opening conviction that we still, that is all of us, still judge people in poverty by believing that they are responsible for their own situation. Tim Huff, who works with street youth in Toronto, was talking about his experience of sitting with street kids who sat on Bay Street in Toronto panhandling. There was one young man there who always kept one hand in his pocket, and with the other hand, he held it out looking for spare change. In the time that Tim Huff sat there with those young men, this young man was spat upon. He was kicked by men in business suits, and he was belittled constantly for not finding a job. Tim reported that these well-to-do folks, with every opportunity in life, looked at these young people as lazy, worthless, and responsible for their own situation. Now, Tim admits that he too was convicted of the fact that when he saw marginalized people, he often made similar assessments of them. I, assuming that most of us do the same. Tim watched this young man with his hand in his pocket endure a couple of hours of abuse from rich strangers just so he could get enough money for a sandwich and a cup of coffee. It's a scene played out in many places and many towns and cities, including this one. Tim then went on with the story to report that the young man finally took his hand out of his pocket, and to Tim's surprise, the young man was missing all four of his fingers. It seems Tim found out that this young man's father, in a drunken rage, had chopped his fingers off. Tim makes the point that most of us would have our impression of this young man changed by that one little piece of information. The point being that the more we know someone, the more we see people as Christ sees them. Now, if I was to ask you this morning to define justice, what would you say? Rick Tobias pointed out that most people would answer with a dictionary definition which reads this way: behavior of oneself to another which is strictly in accord with currently acceptable ethical law or decreed by legal authority. Justice, defined by that, is what is the basis of a lot of our favorite television shows, like Law and Order, for example. The bad guy gets his day in court, right? Justice, defined like this, is the way the Pharisees and the disciples looked on that man born blind. He got what he deserved. His condition was just the conclusion of his parents' sinful behavior, or even his own. Justice, defined this way, looks at someone who's in poverty or homeless and decides they got what they deserved. Jesus, however, his whole life, his whole ministry, reminds us that justice actually has a second definition. Most of us don't know that. The dictionary also states that justice is rectitude for the soul enlivened by grace. That's a lot of words, isn't it? Rephrased, we could say that justice is moral or ethical behavior governed by grace. When Jesus looked at the man born blind, God's view of justice shone brightly on him. People who are governed by grace see the beauty and the worth of all people. The psalmist said, you know, that we are fearfully and wonderfully made. Not just the well-heeled, not just the well-educated, not just the well-connected, but all of humanity is fearfully and wonderfully made. Tim Huff made the point that the reason we need compassionate ministries like food banks, our own first serving, for example, or the warming center, is because in our society, there is no justice, the second kind. If we truly lived in a just society, I mean a society that was infused with grace, the man born blind or the young man with his fingers cut off wouldn't be relegated to begging on the street, suffering abuse from strangers. Mother Teresa said once, "Let no one come to you without leaving happier and better." That's justice. The justice that God seeks. So when Jesus looks at the man born blind, what is the just thing for him to do? It was to heal him, of course. Jesus looked beyond the surface. He knew this man's story. He knew what he dealt with day in and day out. He saw the worth and the beauty in that blind beggar. And Jesus sought to bring him to wholeness. First by healing him, and then what? By revealing himself to him and redeeming him. Now, I ask you to contrast Jesus' treatment of this man with those who knew him to be formerly blind, like his neighbors and his parents and the Pharisees. Did you notice in that story that nobody wanted to celebrate this healing except who? The man himself. Instead, everybody else tried to dismiss what had happened as some kind of a trick or perhaps an incident of mistaken identity. His own parents, who appear to have abandoned him to his fate on the street and are fearful of reprisal from the religious authorities, did not say one word of gladness about his healing. I wonder when I think about this story if that is the knife that cut the deepest in this whole ugly affair. Instead, the parents must have wondered for years what sin they had committed or what sin the fetus had committed to cause the blindness. And now they distance themselves from their own son. He's old enough to speak for himself. Ask him. You know, Rick Tobias, amazing man, makes the point that we become what we celebrate. If we celebrate grace, joy, hope, or dignity, these qualities will be incorporated into our lives. What we believe is precious, that is what we will invest our lives in. For example, simple one, our children are precious to us. So what do? We invest our resources into their care and their advancement. The poor and the marginalized are precious in God's sight, and therefore they need to be precious in our sight too. I find it interesting that the man born blind is never named in this passage. He's not named by Jesus. The Pharisees don't call him by name. Even his own parents don't call him by name. In fact, the only identification he ever gets in this whole story is the man born blind. Perhaps John wanted his name hidden so he could represent all people in his situation. But maybe the lack of a real name is a deliberate way to show how justice had failed this man. With no name, he remains a person without any importance in the world's eyes. Furthermore, as we read the story, we see the Pharisees did not even know who he was. The man born blind was a stranger to them. The very people who should have known from the scriptures that God's justice was one of grace and that the poor are precious in his sight have never met the one who should have received their attention. Instead of grace, the man born blind receives nothing but harsh words, relentless questioning, and in the end of it all, he's called a sinner, and he's tossed out of the synagogue. He's excommunicated. The religious leaders would rather condemn him and excommunicate him than embrace him and celebrate this great thing that happened to him. And of course, John is making a clear connection between physical blindness and spiritual blindness, isn't he? The ones who are truly blind were those who failed or outright refused to see the truth. Truth that God's kingdom is expressed in grace, and the truth that we willingly or unwittingly contribute to the oppression of others. By ignoring the man born blind, by threatening him and his family, by failing to celebrate the grace that was extended to him, and by excommunicating him from the faith community, his whole community was oppressing him. Rick Tobias asked us another question at Mission Fest that really stuck with me. He asked how we might unwittingly oppress others. Actually, he went on to say that we all oppress others. He gave examples of how we have cheap food and cheap clothing that we enjoy that's often prepared by people who are in extreme poverty in other countries. Retailers pressure suppliers to constantly lower their prices, which means poor wages and bad working conditions. Economic poverty is the result of an unjust society, a society in which grace is absent. So the question needs to be asked in light of John 9, how do we respond to our own blindness, you and I? Are we prepared to become people motivated by grace, or shall we remain tied to the first definition of justice, all about laws and regulations and rules? If God had done that, stuck to the first definition, my goodness, we'd be in big trouble, wouldn't we? Under the first definition of justice, none of us is guiltless. The Apostle Paul writes that we've all sinned and fallen short of the glory of God, and that the wages of sin is death. In the matter of God versus humanity, we are all guilty, we are all sentenced to death. It is the just response by a just God. However, as Jesus demonstrated throughout his entire life and through his teaching and through his miracles and continues to demonstrate even today, God chooses to apply the second aspect of justice in dealing with you and I. Paul writes, while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. God in Christ shows his heart is not to condemn the world as the Pharisees thought, but rather to save the world. Is it not time for you and I to apply that same kind of heart to those that we encounter in our community who need the justice of grace?